Okay, so this morning, again, we're going to warm up by warming our voices up. I played Ultimate Frisbee with the kids on the lawn last night, and then I read more than one chapter of Harry Potter aloud before bed in the Holden Village air, so I'm a little bit raspy this morning. But I am still a firm believer in warming ourselves up in as many ways as we can. So do you want to sing the round that we sung yesterday, or do you want to do a different song that I'm going to make you get out of your chairs for?
Love, love, love.
Love, love, love? Okay. Oh, and I was going to write the words on the board, but I have failed.
It's pretty simple.
It's pretty simple, but people kept losing it last time. So the words are... Love, 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 love.
People, we are made for love.
Love your neighbor, love yourself, and love your God. So I'll see how my ultimate frisbee voice does. And you can join in quickly to help. So love, 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 love. People, we are made for love. Love your neighbor, love yourself, and love your God. Love, 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 love. People, we are made for love. Love your neighbor. It's going to be amazing by the end of the week, or everybody's going to be totally worn out, or both.
What's your alternative going to be if you believe and I believe?
No.
No? You know that one?
No. Or I've sung it, but I couldn't teach it.
Years ago, we can help you with it.
Yeah. Okay. I am up for all manner of additional voices being brought in. One of the things that I'm going to keep on doing that I did last session. My name is Laurel Dykstra, and we are reading Matthew 15, 21 to 28, focusing on issues of difference and power. And we're going to be doing that all week long in different ways. One of the ways in a setting like Holden Village that in lots of ways is really uniform and monochromatic, by which I mean mighty white, is to bring the words and the poetry and the songs of people and voices who aren't here. So that's going to keep being a recurring theme here. I'm going to start with a reflection from a woman named Gloria Anzaldúa, who is a feminist Tejana poet. So a woman who is Latina and indigenous, who lived in Mexico. I believe she died between 5 and 10 years ago, but was really a remarkable voice for her own experience, which was an experience of being a person, a woman in male-dominated society, a person of color in white-dominated society, a woman of indigenous and European heritage. And she's best known for her book of autobiographical essays called Borderlands, The New Mixta, The New Woman Mixture. And she edited a collection of essays called This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color. And as we're talking today about crossing boundaries and borders and entering into new spaces and leaving culture and encountering culture, she seemed like a really important voice to draw in. So she says about her experience and about people who share her experience. Bridges are thresholds to other realities. Archetypical, primal symbols of shifting consciousness. They are passageways, conduits and connectors that connote transitioning, crossing borders, and changing perspectives. Bridges span liminal threshold spaces between worlds, spaces that I call Nepanta, a Nahuatl word meaning tierra entre medio, the land in the middle. Transformations occur in this in-between space, an unstable, unpredictable, precarious, always in transition space, lacking clear boundaries. Nepantla es tierra desconocido, is unknown territory. And living in this liminal zone means being in a constant state of displacement, an uncomfortable, even alarming feeling. And some of us dwell in Nepantla so much of the time, it's become a sort of home. And though this state links us to other ideas, people, and worlds, we feel threatened by these new connections and the change they engender. So as we get ready to talk about borders and bridges and unknown territory and the changes that those engender and encounter those in our sacred story, I want to do a speedy review. This is a conversation about power and about difference. And the main categories of difference that we're going to talk about were kind of raised yesterday as we examined this text, the story of Matthew, the story in Matthew of Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman. We're going to talk today mostly about race, culture, and ethnicity. We're going to talk tomorrow about gender. We're going to talk on Thursday about faith traditions and religious difference. And we're going to talk on Friday about disability and ableism. And all of these have powerful links to the story that we're going to be encountering. The other aspect of the conversation is power. And so to get a better idea and to have some common experience of what we're talking about when we say power, I think the most common experience that everyone has of powerlessness is that all of us have experienced powerlessness in childhood. That when you're a child, adults are in charge. And so for our first exercise, and because there's noise in the background, and because a couple of people said to me, focus on speaking clearly. If you're having trouble hearing me, I would really invite you to move closer to where I am, because I can't, with the setup, move closer to where you are. So we're going to do an exercise now that's an individual exercise. You don't need to move anywhere or pair up. But I invite you to think back to your childhood, to a time before you were 10 years old, maybe even a time before you were 5 years old. A time when you were aware that you did not have power and that the adults were in charge. And I want you to think about how that power was communicated. Did your teacher have a big desk and you had a little desk? Did everybody shut up when your father came into the room? Think about an experience of your own where you were aware that the adults had power and that the children didn't. And think about the ways that that were communicated. Did you get to walk where you wanted to go, or did people carry you around? Were there gates at the top of the stairs? So think of some other ways. Give me some examples of just the way that power is communicated. some examples from your memory. What did you think of, and how did you know that the adults were in charge? How did you know that you weren't?
If you didn't do what you were asked to do, there would be consequences that were uncomfortable.
There would be uncomfortable consequences. Okay. So you had experience that told you what would happen. What else?
Lack of choice.
Lack of choice.
I was made to wear long brown socks to school.
Long brown socks. So people even had control over what you put on your body.
Yeah. Where you went.
Where you went.
And when.
Mm-hmm. So your timetable and your geography.
Mm-hmm. What you ate.
What you ate. So what you eat is an issue of power and control.
How much you ate.
How much you ate. Whether you cleaned your plate.
Yeah.
Whether I was excused from the table.
Whether you
spinach in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And eat.
When you went to bed.
When you went to bed.
Huh?
Okay, so let's keep all of these ideas and you know, as more bubble up, just kind of think and mark them. And those kind of markers and power are at play in different ways, in all the kinds of ways of power imbalance that we're going to talk about. That power is demonstrated on people's bodies, on people's geography, on people's timetables, on who they can associate with and when, in issues of racism, disability, classism. All of those ways that power are exercised are shown in symbolic ways, like who has the big desk, and are played out on bodies. I want to review. We talked yesterday about the four I's of isms. And the ways that oppression and power and control are played out. And I want to use the example of racism, although there's certain cautions when using race to talk about biblical situations. But I'm going to quickly go through the list of four I's that we talked about yesterday and just think about, give an example for each of these. So you can substitute in when you're having another conversation, sexism, classism, heterosexism, but right now we're going to use the example of racism. So, racism is interpersonal. It happens between people. And this is the easiest kind of racism to recognize because it's usually very overt. And often when we think and we talk about racism, we keep our focus right up on here. It's about bad people and mean people and the things that they say. And we don't very often move down into the deeper and underpinning and historical roots of what's going on. So an example of interpersonal racism is if I have a basement suite and I only rent it to white people, that is an interpersonal example of racism. Racism is also ideological. If I think that Asians are bad drivers, I can find a host of people who will agree with me in the city of Vancouver. I can find websites dedicated to trashing Asian drivers. I can find lists of Asian driver syndrome. So there is ideology behind racism. That there is a structure of ideas, and often, like historically, especially around race and gender, it's been the impetus for a whole heck of a lot of what we call science. So, racism is ideological. It is also institutional. In Canada, where I live, overwhelmingly, the prison population is made up of Aboriginal people, Aboriginal women. Even though Aboriginal people make up less than 3% of the population, in some places they are 25% of the prison population. That is institutional racism. In the United States, African Americans who commit violent crimes against white people are much, much more harshly sentenced than white people who commit violent crimes against white people. That is institutionalized racism. That is how the structures uphold the interpersonal, the ideological. And then there's internalized racism and people who are members of a target group. From the get-go, live in an atmosphere of institutional, ideological, and interpersonal racism. People of color are bombarded with the messages of white superiority, of white supremacy. And many people internalize that. Many children of color want white Barbie, an internalized ideal of white, Nordic, impossible beauty. And so all of those are in operation, and those four things will be in operation in the stories that we read and will be in operation in our interactions all the time. So now we're going to do an exercise a little bit in groups. I think groups of three is the way to go. So form, when I say go, a group of three, ideally with two other people who you don't know or don't know well. Exchange names. And then when you're in the groups, I'll give you the next part of the instruction. So you can group up your chairs because there's going to be a little bit of conversation to go on. So when you've got comfy and exchange names, what I want you to do is to remember a time when you stepped out of the culture and the community that you were raised in. And this doesn't have to be the first time that it happened. It could be an example from any time in your life. And culture is communicated through language, through race, through food. But a time when you were aware that you weren't at home anymore. That you weren't with your people anymore. That you were in a new and different place. And ideally, this should not be about a time when you were a tourist. Because often tourism is about spectating and consuming other culture and not about kind of a real personal encounter. So take a minute, remember a time in your past when you stepped out of your own culture and place, and think about the details about what you remember. What did it feel like to you? How did you know you were somewhere else? What were the smells? Did you eat something different? What did it sound like? And when you're ready, fast or slow, share a little bit about that memory, as much or as little as you feel comfortable with the people around you, but especially focusing on how did you know that you weren't at home. As you are ready, please come back into the circle. So how was that for folks? Anything that you particularly wanted to share out of your group? Anything that you noticed? And one of the things that I would say is if it was difficult for you at the beginning to think of an experience when you were immersed in another culture, that in a group with less white faces, it would be much easier for most people to identify many times when, by choice and not by choice, they were not in their own culture.
I was just going to say, it seemed to me that, since all of us here appear to be white, I guess, that all of us sort of, at least not all of us, but people in my group had all similar stories about, encountering either non-whiteness or not the same religion, and kind of an awareness that where we're coming from, whether we state it or not, we're kind of aware is more or less the dominant beliefs, not belief system, but the dominant institutionalized system. So, I don't think you get that same reflection as much from people who are non-white or non-Christian. Maybe having the same.
say something? We spent 4 years in the Philippines, and so that's a totally different, and on a military base, which I had never had any influence in. But I remember when we had monsoons, and I lived in a nice house on base, and we lost our power for several days, and my main problem with it was the heat. I didn't have my air conditioning. And the people out in the countryside, in their huts, they were absolutely devastated. They lost everything, and I'm uncomfortable. And they have nothing, and I'm going to cry.
Mm-hmm. So all of those power differentials.
Yeah.
And
I was too hot.
And to be absolutely immersed in a couple of different cultures,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
still be separate.
Yeah, I had never had influence with military. So, and also people from the East Coast. I was raised in Washington and had never lived in another state. So I had people from our own country and a military base and the Philippines. So there were a lot of differences right there in one. That's one thing that really comes to my mind right now, was the devastation they had and my minor discomfort.
About 3 years ago, my husband and I went to Matsalon, and we walked into, well, we took the city bus and walked into a church. We didn't know it was a church. And the next day or so, they were going out to the dump, and so we went with them. And stacks and stacks and stacks of junk, and people are going through it for their livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
Pieces of cardboard, plastic bottles. Their whole existence was to get enough for a few pennies to turn the cardboard in to buy some food. I don't, it's a whole different world. And the odors, we took them sandwiches, oranges, and water. And they couldn't speak our language, of course. But some were grateful, some didn't acknowledge. They just took it and went on with their work. One old lady had a cart, a donkey looked like it. They were both going to crumble over for old age any minute. And her whole life was to find cardboard and then go back into town for the evening. Then they go back out the same day and repeat the process. A whole different slant on life.
So a really powerful encounter with poverty. And also, so again, like levels of culture there, that you were visiting a Mexican church that was visiting the people who were earning their living on the dump. And so all of those levels.
Something that I hadn't, an experience that I had back in 1984, I just graduated from college and I was a teacher on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, had no experience with American Indians prior to that. And I found myself as a chaperone on a school outing. One of their extracurricular activities was dancing at powwows. And I found myself in a huge gym. And I might have been able to find a few other people who were not American Indian, but most people there were American Indian. And I the one thing that I'm just now realizing is that I felt out of my element, but I didn't feel like the people there were putting me in that space. I think that they were, you know, very gracious and they didn't, you know, considering all the things that kind of white culture has done to their generations of people, I didn't feel any anger or animosity or anything. I was just there. And I was kind of stayed off to the side a bit because I wasn't quite sure what the expectations were. But it's interesting that I'm just now realizing that they weren't projecting that sort of stuff on me.
I just thought of something that I might have influenced me. As a little girl, I visited Washington, D.C. a lot with my relatives, and to visit my relatives in the summer. And I wasn't allowed, where I was raised in Connecticut, I could go anywhere, and I had so much freedom, it was amazing. And then when I went to visit them, I was not allowed to, So I don't know, I have to think about that, whether that influenced my attitude or not. I mean, that's something to look into.
Thank you for that, because it reminded me that when I was about fifth grade, we moved from a small kind of country area in Wisconsin to Minneapolis schools. And I was in a very mixed school, a lot of African-American kids. And what I would now call cultural differences and economic differences were just so startling to me. And a way of talking to each other. And the way black kids talked to me was different than the way they talked to each other.
So all kinds of encounters of power and difference and fear and safety and privilege and risk and pulling in themes that I've heard since I've been here, also the experience of vulnerability. So let's read the Bible. I'm going to split the group again. Folks who were here yesterday did this, and folks who are new will catch on pretty quickly, kind of between Matt and the fellow in the Icelandic kind of sweater. I don't know your name.
Eric.
Okay. So we'll sort of split there. The first group will read us all the way through the passage, reading a verse at a time. So a little bit of paying attention to the person next to you. And when your group is done, then stick your finger in the page and hold it, but don't pore over each word. Just listen. So Matthew 15, 21 to 28.
Just a verse at a time.
Just a verse at a time. So you read verse 21, then you read verse 22, and then you'll come kind of right along, and you in the striped shirt are with this group.
Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon.
Just then a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon."
But he did not answer her at all, and his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us."
He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel."
The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs."
She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table."
And Jesus answered her, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed instantly.
Okay, so everybody who has had a chance to read, close your books and just listen. And then the next eight folks along here will read again. So do you want to start with verse 21?
Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon.
Just then a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon."
But he did not answer her at all. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us."
He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel."
But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me."
He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs."
She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table."
And then Jesus answered her, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish." So thinking about your own experiences of culture and power and difference and privilege and encounter with others, what do you notice? Let's just have a discussion. Don't put up your hands.
I noticed three things. Mm-hmm. The first thing is that Jesus changes his mind. He came to serve a certain population, but this woman says, "Oh, no, I need you."
The other thing is that desperate people do desperate things. She wasn't the one in the other side, not for a second. She had a goal. And then the other one is that this woman challenges Jesus publicly.
I noticed today, differently than yesterday, that apparently the disciples' complaint about her is not that she's a foreigner, but that she's noisy.
Hysterical.
I think it shows the power of what a mother will do for her child. She may not have done the same thing for herself.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, this was resonating with the memory I had of being in a different culture as a child, being close to the what was then called the Negro neighborhood, the African American neighborhood. My dad being their letter carrier, having a grocery store in the midst where we would all shop. Mm-hmm. But my dad was a pianist. He would play at this worship service. And the people there were desperate in some sense, because as a child I would go there repeatedly. And it was like entering a whole different world. And the people there, as they were crying out to God, would be so fervent and urgent and desperate and unbounded. You know, there's the Amen corner, and there's lots of talk of freedom, which made no sense to me. I didn't know anybody needed to be freed from anything as a child, you know. What is that? And then when you'd meet each other in the grocery store, it would be like all of a sudden I'm seeing like who Jesus thinks he is at this point here, of not even responding, where the white people I knew would be pretty much the same in talking to each other, and these people I've experienced as being crying out and desperate and kind of over the top in a way that was both exciting and scary to me, were like not even seen or responded to in the grocery store. It was like, are these the same people who, you know, when they were crying out to God, they were there, but the white people were like not even really seeing them. And I, of course, didn't really know what to do with that as a child, but it really brought back that stark image when I read Jesus didn't respond. I thought, there's this crying out. And, you know, so it really resonated with that early experience of mine.
I appreciate what you said about desperate people, like, doing what they need to. And one of the things that it makes me think of, and just kind of like putting together what I'm hearing and how it's resonating inside myself, is that I think when I'm in situations where I'm crossing cultural boundaries, like including interpersonally, oftentimes because I've learned a little bit about this, it's like I want to do it right. And so I get caught up in, like, I'm having an interaction, and I get caught up in how do I negotiate the situation in a way that's gonna be just and clear, and just the thought of that impulse being, I want to make a connection with you. Like, can we just speak frankly and forthrightly, as opposed to dancing this delicate dance that nobody feels good in? It's like the woman here just cuts right through it. And it's like that gives me a sense of a courage that I'd like to have also, which is not being caught up in this kind of porcelain interaction, but instead, like, yeah, things suck. Like, what are we going to do right now? You know? Something more frank.
So you're saying you feel almost desperate and like want to communicate with someone that's of a different culture. You don't want to dance around, right?
Right.
But it's almost, you almost have to have a desperation.
Yeah, like, let's just go for it. Like, let's not be stuck in the scripts of...
Right. Not always easy.
No.
I think when you're in the throes of desperation, like this woman was, you would be forthright. If you're not desperate, why would you? You don't need to be.
She actually didn't have anything to lose at that point.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if you're in desperation, when I'm in desperation, you know it. I mean, there's no doubt bones about it. I need help. I mean, I will say it. How I get it, it doesn't matter. It's just a question of, if I'm desperate, I'm not going to dance. That's for sure. That's, yeah.
A number of people's personal reflections talked about sort of multiple levels of crossing over, of being in the Philippines on a military base, being in Mexico with the Mexican church visiting an impoverished dump scavenging community. So the levels of crossing over. In the Matthew version of this story, Jesus and the disciples are clearly outside of their home, have crossed over. In the story, the Canaanite woman, and we should talk a little bit about Canaanite, then sort of crosses into their insider, insular circle. In the Markan version of the story, she physically crosses the border and storms the house. Jesus is indoors and doesn't want people to know. And so there's here, the Matthew Gospeler has taken the story and Jesus has made the transition, the physical transition. And so I think that layering, you know, all of this within in the context of the Roman Empire and big power and little power and cultural power and gender power is all getting played out in really complicated ways.
I add too that the text doesn't say one word about why is Jesus going to Tyre and Sidon.
He was just in the synagogue, like.
Yeah, and then immediately after the scene, it says, and he left that place and passed along the Sea of Galilee. You know, back where you expect him to be. But like, what's he doing there? It doesn't say he preached to anybody or he has any particular, God told him to go there or anything. He's just, you have no reason at all to wonder why he's, or why she's there. That's not her area either.
Well, and maybe you can help me on the whole geography, which I am not good at. But as I understand it, Tyre and Sidon are not so close together. So it's sort of a near and even further. So that there's...
Well, Tyre is famously an island, right? So you can't just go to the... It's to the, I don't have the Greek in front of me to know what the word is that's translating district here. If that implies some realm of political power that's subject to Tyre and Sidon within the Roman imperial context, but you can't just go to Tyre. What's, it's like saying they went to Cuba, although it's not as far.
You have to have a boat to get there.
What's that?
Like Holden, you have to have a boat to get there.
Yeah, and there's plenty of boat crossing stories, but it didn't say anybody taking any boat to Tyre.
And the word, I know that in verse 22 there, the word that's translated region, she came from that region. I don't remember what the word is, but that the word, it's literally borderlands, from those border regions. She's that kind of liminal person. She's kind of from these frontier areas between places.
And we talked yesterday as well about her being a Canaanite woman, that in the Markan story, that she's not referred to as Canaanite, and that's kind of an archaic term. Mm-hmm. That's pulling and a whole lot of old stories and kind of mega stories into this conversation where Canaanites are the indigenous people of the Promised Land, and they're both warned against, conquered, and you know, you better not have any truck with their gods. And, you know, kind of historically, archaeologically, social, scientifically, we know that the people of Israel and the Canaanites are pretty much the same, that there's not a lot of difference there. And so there's sort of this conflicted, is she one of us, isn't she one of us? We and they, and there's a whole lot, I think, in this story of what Jesus has internalized and what she has internalized.
I'd add even another element to that. Canaanite is a generic term that doesn't actually mean anything particular. So earlier you talked about Asian drivers, well, who's an Asian? You know, who's an Indian? You know, a Native American or Indian. Nobody here called themselves Indians. They were Duwamish or Puyallup or whatever. The Canaanite is this generic term that the Israelites put on the people of the land. Nobody called themselves Canaanites.
It seems to me that from some of the comments that we do experience sort of what I would call Jesus moments, where we are confronted with the stranger, we are the strangers in a different culture, but they are strangers to us, or strangers on our streets. I had the experience of working in a food bank and also with a recovery program, and those folks they cut right through and respond, expect you to respond in some way. And I think the uncomfortableness in terms of how to respond is how to respond. And if you're not familiar with the talk, you can respond as a nice white American person, or you can get into what you might say is gutter talk if you understand it. But those people want to talk. They have needs that they're trying to express, or they just want to talk, And so my experience has been you just need to get past the uncomfortableness of dealing with a person that you don't know, or a stranger, and yet responding to their needs, whatever they happen to be. And it can make, I know it's made me very uncomfortable. There can be lots of demands. They may just want to talk. And I get that from this exchange. Jesus is responding on several different levels, but also there's a lot of cultural and institutional ideological issues going on as well, how to deal with them. And that's what we're getting when we are in a strange place or when we meet people in our own country who really are desperate.
Yeah, and I really appreciate your bringing all of those levels, that it's easiest and most sort of familiar and comfortable for us to read the text at the interpersonal level. What's going on with Jesus? What's his message to the women? What's his message to the disciples? How are we like Jesus or the woman or the disciples? But the issues around how are power structures challenged? How do we live in resistance to what we've inherited, that those are, I think, the greater part of the conversation and often a part that it's easy to neglect.
I'd say there is a place, though, in here where it's not just interpersonal at the one-on-one level, because he refers to her as part of a group collectively, plural, the dogs. Mm-hmm. And she accepts that category. I think it's parallel in a certain way, it's a very different story, but it's parallel in a certain way to John 4, which is one we're going to do on Thursday, but where Jesus and the woman at the well in Samaria both talk in the plural, first and second person plural. So she becomes a representative of Samaritans, and she sees him as a representative of Judeans. So like when you go to Pine Ridge, you represent white people, and you go to Mexico, you represent Americans. Even though you didn't go to be the designated ambassador of America, but you become one of your people, as perceived, even if you're one-on-one.
As we're talking about parallel stories, I was thinking about last night how this is a story that appears in Mark and that appears in Matthew. And even though Luke is the, sort of the gospel that's famous for women's stories, it's really not a story that could appear in Luke. That the kind of outrageousness and inappropriateness of this woman is a story that wouldn't go down as well in Luke.
How about the woman in Luke 7 who barges in on the Pharisees' dinner and starts washing Jesus' feet with her tears and her hair? That's pretty outrageous.
Yeah.
Woman. woman of the city, perceived as a sinner by the crowd. So I don't know.
I think, though, that when you look at it, you know, with your things, the different levels, there's something very empowering. Like, I think about, we hadn't seen an old friend in 4 years, and he all of a sudden showed up. We ran into him at Folk Life in Seattle. He's my son's godfather, and we're up late at night, and we're going for pizzas. So we're kind of this gathering of not all white, Mexican and American community, but we have our agenda of what we're doing. And this woman comes up to us, and she was a black woman, and she goes, "Help me." And I think about, like, my ideology was, oh, I don't have any money on me right now. You know, I immediately jump to, here's someone on the street asking for help, it's financial. And that's coming from that ideological place. And then feeling like, and I sat, and she goes, no, just listen to me a moment. And I sat just for 15, 20 minutes and heard her story, and I left feeling like I failed. Like somehow here was a moment for me to understand and to grow, and I left feeling like I missed it. I missed something, and trying to unpack what did I, and thinking, because I couldn't get into the institutional and the internalized story in the moment for me to fully kind of enter into whatever part I can grow from that experience, I would have to take it to those next places rather than just hearing her story. You know, that there's not much I can do in that interpersonal place. Because it wasn't institutionalized, you know, it's so much more. So I think looking at this feels very empowering in a way, is to say, okay, when I address something, I need to unpack it at multiple levels too.
Mm-hmm, yeah, because if you're an ally and nice at the interpersonal level and you haven't addressed all of the others, they stay there.
I keep thinking about, your story calls forth another one for me, which is about 12 years ago, I was working with an organization called Christian Peacemaker Teams in Mexico. And I got to know this guy who was, I was about 25, and he was about 25, and we were both poets, and he worked at the Mayan Medicine Museum, where we would go to get the native treatment for Giardia when we got Giardia. So I got to know him a couple of times in that context. And his name was Chuno, X-U-N-O. And one time I was going back up to the States, and I was going to be coming back down. And he knew that. And Christian Peacemaker Teams has this, perspective that in our work, like, there's nothing economic between us and the communities that we work in. So, like, there's no transfer of funds or any gifts or anything like that. And he and I were going for a walk soon before I was going to go back up to the States, and he's like, I would like you to buy me a sleeping bag and bring it back for me, and I'll give you the money. And he said, we just can't get the kind of sleeping bags that I would like to have here. And it made me feel so awkward. You know, because our policy was really clear, we're there as unarmed bodyguards working in communities under threat, no economic, we don't want to be perceived at all as an aid organization. And I said no, and our friendship ended. And I think that it ended because of my awkwardness. I don't know. I mean, maybe I can say I don't know why it ended. But I think part of it was I just didn't know how to negotiate that. And he was so clear, like, just buy me a sleeping bag. I'll give you the money. I don't want the money from you. You just have access to something that I don't have. And I felt like I screwed up.
It's interesting to think about I've been in... I'm primarily have relationships with women. I was in a relationship for 20 years, which ended about 5 years ago. I've been in a relationship for the last 4 years. We have 4 kids between us. I've spent all of those years building a lot of interpersonal safe space, space where I feel like, you know, family, friends, community, church, we've found space that is supportive to us, but all the rest of those three things aren't happening. You know, we can't get married. We don't have the opportunities to protect our family and support our family in the same way as people who have the legal right to get married. And a lot of times I, you know, in my younger days I worked more on those other things because I had more time and energy to do that. Now I'm focused on raising my children, and so I'm not working in that on those other things as much. But it makes me reflect back on other cultures and other racism and classism and all of those things. And it seems like that interpersonal is a lot easier and a lot more accessible than all of those other levels. And that it takes a lot more of our effort. You know, interpersonal is one-on-one. You can tell me something about yourself and I can change my personal opinion about that aspect. But unless I then address with you some of those other things, then I haven't fully engaged. I haven't fully moved. And like I said, it has to be more than just me changing my thoughts and opinions. It's that I need to work toward those other, the deeper levels of whatever the ism is.
Thank you, everyone. We just heard our 5-minute bell. One last point that I want to highlight before I do the closing piece is, because we've been talking so much about borders, I want to briefly kind of highlight prayerfully places where there are walls and borders, and to raise the issue of who crosses borders easily. And the power and privilege that's inherent in that. I want to do a quick commercial. In the bookstore, you can find copies of my book on Exodus. When we talked yesterday about projects that we were, work that we were proud of, I've recently finished a collaborative project, a book that I co-edited with Ched Myers called Liberating Biblical Study, and it brings together the work of scholarship, activism, and art, commenting on different biblical texts. And it's really a project that in a lot of ways embodies some of the stuff that we're doing here, bringing the stories of our lives and the stories of Scripture together. And the last thing we're going to do is a closing reading from Gloria Anzaldúa. The Liberating Biblical Study came out a week ago yesterday. It is not physically here in Holden Village, but folks can find it online through Whip and Stop Publishers, and in about a week or two, you can also order it through like Ingram and Amazon, or go into your local religious bookstore and say, get us this. And the more they order, the cheaper it is for them, and the better it is for me. So finally, to close, and this brings together, again, the experience of being someone from more than one home and place, and again, the theme in the story of bread and crumbs and what is enough and who is in and who is out. I am an act of needing, of uniting and joining that has not only produced both a creature of darkness and a creature of light, but also a creature that questions the definitions of light and dark and gives them new meanings. So, let us go forth from this place to live our stories.